Shrink Wrap Radio number 286, Understanding Jungian Active Imagination, with Dr. Monica Wickman.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is author and Jungian analyst, Dr. Monica Wickman, who previously was my guest on episode number 235, Using Alchemical Archetypes in Jungian Analysis. Today we'll be discussing active imagination. For more detail on her background, please visit our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Dr. Monica Wickman, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
I am so pleased to have you back. Last time we discussed your book on pregnant darkness, and today I'd like to pick your brain on active imagination. So perhaps we can begin with a definition of active imagination. It's a concept that I think has a long history in Jungian psychology. So maybe give us a definition and some sense of the history of the concept.
Okay, great. Well, I hope that your readers find some of this helpful for their own practice. To start with, the activated imagination probably began when first people stared into fire or gazed into a reflective pond and the faculties of the imagination awakened. And the process of using active imagination, as Jung honed it, it's a process of sitting still with the dialogue with the unconscious and sitting still with what's outside of ego awareness. And it helps stretch the encapsulated ego, realign it with a source of life, energy that flows in the psyche through images, through felt experiences, sometimes energetics, that realigns life and brings more energy. It also is a confrontation, of course, with whatever arises. In terms of the history of working with the imaginal, the alchemists, of course, had this phenomenon happening, and they'd be gazing into their vessels and learning the arts and science of transformation as doorways to the imagination, you know, were peaked and opened in the process. And they'd write down their perceptions, and even more importantly, they drew these emblems of the mysteries that they were seeing, and they used these emblems among themselves, so like a trade secret, to portray and hold these alchemical changes that they were both witnessing in psyche and matter and also were experiencing deeply in themselves and affected by the work they were doing. When Jung landed with alchemy, he saw that he found home, because he saw that the alchemists were doing this practice of active imagination.
One thing that's never been clear to me is, you know, sometimes the alchemists are depicted as the foundations of chemistry, if you will, of the science of chemistry. And then on the other hand, it looks like they were engaged in this very sort of mystical kind of practice. And so I'm not sure how the two connect. Did the alchemists know that they were practicing esoteric knowledge, or did they think they were doing science, or was it both?
That's perfect. That's perfect, Dr. Dave. I think that still stands in all kinds of research that happens nowadays, where we realize that the presence of the observer changes the actual experiment and outcome of what we're observing. This has come out, of course, in current research time and again, and that was true for the alchemists. They would step in thinking they were doing one thing. We could picture them, for example, maybe they were strong sensation thinking types who'd step in and think they're going to, you know, literally transmute certain matter into gold and would be, you know, marking down everything they'd be doing very scientifically. And then, of course, as they're peering into the vessel, these other processes would start to go on around the imaginal. And there were alchemists definitely who began to understand that what they were actually doing was another kind of gold, that it was a soul gold that was getting honed in their work, and they began, like Gerhard Dorn and others, became aware of this. Now, there are others who didn't know that that's what was happening, and they would try to stay with just working with actual matter. But, of course, what we find from alchemy and now physics these days too, one doesn't work with just actual matter, because matter is also full of spirit. It's full of psyche. There's no such thing as the hard division any longer between spirit and matter. We understand from many different languages and lenses of perception now that mystery. So the original scientists, yes, trying to get hard science going while all this intuitive process kicked in. It's a giant debate behind alchemy, and it's interesting to see when you look at the processes of the alchemists, which ones were going which direction.
Yeah, well, you've given me a new thought, which is that maybe it has some kind of relationship to magic. Not magic in the sense of a magician who does sleight of hand, but rather the kind of magic that functions along the idea that our emotions and our imaginal world, if you will, may have some mapping to or effect on reality.
Very true. Very true. And in fact, this is the beauty behind and inside alchemy. And of course, many people are practicing alchemy in different ways these days. Anytime we're working with the imaginal, we're working with what you're talking about also as magic. And I think of magic as a change of perception. Mm-hmm. Literally, our lenses of perception learn to see and hear in new ways. And this is what Jung gets at, that the value behind active imagination and the reason for it was what he speaks about as the religious function. It's honing a new center of consciousness that's beyond the ego complex, that relates us to the larger realities of the psyche, and that teaches us to see and to hear in new ways. And when we're seeing and hearing in ever new ways, and it really is ever new ways, it's subtle organs develop as we work with the imaginal to be able to experience what you're thinking of as you mentioned magic.
I'm recalling in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, Jung's autobiographical book, that he describes as a boy sitting on a rock and puzzling over, am I the rock that's being sat upon, or am I the sitter on the rock? And he talked about his own inner experience of a personality one and a personality two. Mm-hmm. Maybe that early experience that he talks about fits in here somewhere.
I think it really does. You're right. All throughout Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, if he's looking at the number one personality, number two, as he thinks about himself and his own perceptions as a boy, and then also he saw it in his mother very strongly. And I think that's exactly what we're talking about. So, it's interesting when you mention Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, and you think about how the whole book begins. It begins with that quote from Coleridge at the introduction, and it says, he looked at his own soul with a telescope. What seemed all irregular, he saw and showed to be beautiful constellations, and he added to the consciousness hidden worlds within worlds.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
Yeah,
it is. And it's great that you've got it memorized.
Yeah, well, it's so potent because I think this is what we begin to see, and certainly Jung, the biography and autobiography starts off right with that quote for a reason, because once our lenses of perception are cleansed and we're opening to active imagination and the number one and number two personality and these other realities, then we literally have a cosmological shift that happens. And our sense of the cosmos that we're a part of, it grows and shifts. And it's not an idea or a religion, it's an experience. So it literally worlds within worlds start to open. And I think it's great you brought in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. I just love how he started it.
Well, I think that's really interesting that Coleridge's poem has the image of looking through a telescope to examine the soul. And mm-hmm. I think we've all speculated at one time. We've wondered, we know so much about the microscopic, and mm-hmm. we know so much about the macroscopic at this point. Of course, there's also a lot that we don't know. But but it's probably the rare person who hasn't wondered, well, I wonder if we're like the microscopic world, if we're just, like a molecule of something that's much mm-hmm. larger. So that image of somebody looking through a telescope, looking out to examine the soul. And it also makes me think of images that I think they're either alchemical images or perhaps images I've seen on a tarot card of a guy with a stargazing pointy hat who's mm-hmm. who's looking through a telescope.
Mm-hmm.
As
oh, yes.
kind of alchemist who's using a telescope, but also in search of the soul.
Yes, there's a beautiful woodcut from the 1300s by Flammarion, and it shows this alchemist peering through. He's kind of crouched on the earth, and he's looking out beyond the known stars to the realms beyond, and there's a telescope and other images as well. And it was really fun as someone on the internet changed that image around, and they have him sitting outside in the unknown world looking back in on this world.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's really important because I think once we get contact with these experiential realities of the psyche that are much larger, we literally appreciate the minute so much more for the mysteries it contains. Mm-hmm. It changes the way we relate to daily life, to our bodies, to each other, to having a little human life. That becomes much more mysterious. Our lenses of perception see matter and the tiny in new ways.
Yeah, it's all pretty astounding, actually.
Yes.
whether you're going down or you're going up, it's astounding in both directions.
And yes.
Now, I know the name Barbara Hannah at some mm-hmm. point is associated with active imagination. Who was Barbara Hannah, and at what point did she come along?
Well, Barbara Hannah was an English woman living in Zurich, and she lived with von Franz for many years, with Marie-Louise von Franz for many, many years, which was Jung's right hand, basically, in his work on alchemy. And she had a strong feeling, intuitive personality, and she wrote a tremendous book called Active Imagination, Encounters with the Soul. And it's very potent. It's not for the faint-hearted. It does really show active imagination at work. And I think of, in terms of people around Jung who really grounded the work and wrote about it, it definitely would be Barbara Hannah, who was a very heartful friend of Jung's as well.
Well, I remember, too, there were a series of films coming out of the UK, the story of C.G. Jung, and I think it was either there or Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, or both, an account of Jung, of his waterworks, that he used to play with stones in a stream, building dams and mm-hmm. and little structures. And it reminded me of my youth growing up part-time in the mountains outside of Los Angeles, and there was a creek there, and I used to spend hours and hours, you know, trying to dam up this stream, which was kind of impossible. So that also seems to be an important route for of this active imagination approach.
Well, Dr. Dave, I think what you're saying is so dear because, you know, play and the child at play is exactly where the imaginal comes in. And thinking about you as a boy playing in that creek, you could play endlessly for hours lost in nature. That's so beautiful. And Jung, you know, definitely tried to get back to this divine child energy that would help open the imaginal doors. In fact, at one point, he keeps bringing alive the reality that the self, capital S self, the larger self, is a child playing. So this what we're talking about with the imaginal realms is as natural as you playing at that creek.
And that reminds me of the New Testament quote of Jesus saying, unless you become as a little child, mm-hmm. you can't finish it. But
yes. Then it's, I think, yeah, something like it's hard to get into the kingdom, isn't it? With, you know, unless you become as a child, you can't get in.
Yes.
So that's interesting. So if we think of the kingdom of heaven as, you know, seeing the spiritual and the material world as intertwined in a fluid dance, that puts us into a, you know, feeling of the numinous of something that feels ecstatic to us and feeling our rightful place, that the child knows how to do that. And I'm glad you brought this up. It brings alive just how much this is about life itself. And these instincts are in, I mentioned, you know, first man, first woman looking in the first fire, or the first gazing pond and imaginal waking up. But it's also true in our lives that the child in us and in our early years had natural access and means to this. I also grew up, by the way, in the mountains behind Los Angeles on a creek called Deep Creek. And I would get lost down there for hours and hours and hours and hours, playing in the water and taking the hem out of my pants and trying to catch fish.
I actually discovered that I could catch fish in my hands by plunging it into the dark space under a rock, which I've since learned is illegal. But but as a child, I didn't know, and it was kind of exciting to plunge your hand into this dark space where you couldn't see and then to feel a wiggling trout in your hand.
Yes, absolutely. And it's so dear to do this together. I have to really laugh. The metaphor in what you're saying is just the same impulse. It's the same impulse behind the religious instinct to plunge one's little hand into the dark where we can't see and wait for the life force of something other than us to make itself known. And it, like, as a child, it's like the sensory sense of this little fish suddenly in your little hand. And now, like with, going into active imagination or working with dreams and such, it's the same thing. We literally want to be able to reach into the darkness where we can't see and feel the life force of the psyche that's infusing and living with us and informing us and playing with us. Perfect metaphor.
I love that. You're really bringing it to life. And you talk about staring in the pond and looking into the fire. And that brought into mind the Greeks looking up at the skies and how they came up with all these imaginal entities in the constellations and related it to their mythology.
Yes, and of course that's a whole other topic for us sometime. That is so juicy to look at also how indigenous people, along with classical Greek people, would come up with the same names for stars even.
Really?
Not all the time, but yes, it's really striking to see Sirius, the dog star, through time and through many cultures keeps getting named the dog star.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the way we relate to the star-strewn sky and find mystery in it is a beautiful projective screen of the psyche. That's a whole other topic. It'd be fun to do.
So Barbara Hanna writes this book about active imagination, which I guess establishes it as a solid piece of the Jungian world. Have there been subsequent developments or other contributors who stand out?
Yes, two ones that stand out for me for certain. I think in answering that, I'll also mention, of course, von Franz's work with Act Imagination is incredibly striking. It's throughout everything she's doing. Her book on synchronicity, divination and synchronicity, brings alive very much the activated imaginal field with which the goal of which is to live inside that field. So I think this is important too, that the goal of individuation from von Franz's point of view is to live the active imagination life. It's the symbolic life where everything we're doing, we have a level of hearing that's, hearing the field of synchronicity and what's getting communicated through, the whole world around us continually. So von Franz's work, I would certainly have to name, is just completely the cornerstone behind us. And currently, Jeff Raff's work I find to be incredibly illuminating. And he has each one of his books get into what it's like to hone this new center between consciousness and the unconscious. And as you see Jeff Raff's work develop with active imagination, you see that he has become very related to what he calls the ally. And this, of course, links us to shamanism and other people through time who've had these experiences as well, that active imagination begins to show a partnership between the human and the divine, that both parts are working on this new center. So Jeff Raff, R-A-F-F, I would certainly recommend his work. He's got a current book that came out called A Practical Guide to Ally Work. And this is very easy to read. His other books, Jung and the Alchemical Imagination, that's been translated into a number of different languages. It's sold wonderfully around the world for real reasons. It's extremely substantial piece of Jungian psychology in the world today. And then where I look to other people developing active imagination, I would definitely say the Sufi. The Sufi people have a giant handle on this and have for eons, and it's very, very fresh. It's the Sufi, of course, is the mystic tradition behind the Muslims who definitely are beyond dogma and remarkably free of dogma and fixed thought. And so their relationship to the inner partner who helps in active imagination is very strong. And then a sort of playful sideline, I have to say, is I've had the opportunity to work with the Groff community, and I have to say they're doing quite a bit with active imagination, though they don't call it that.
Now, Jeff Raff, that's a new name to me. Is he a G-E-O-F-F or a J-E-F-F?
Yeah, J-E-F-F and then R-E-Y, Jeffrey Raff, R-A-F-F. And he's a Jungian analyst in Denver, Colorado, and he taught at Pacifica in the past. And his works are, I think, just in terms of something very alive that's going into new directions with Jung's foundation, I look to Jeff's work.
Now, when you talk about his work and the work that he's done on the LI, that brings to mind Jung's Red Book, which came out so recently, and it seems like maybe the character of Philemon would qualify there. What are your thoughts about that?
That's perfect. Yes, you're well read. Well, that book is not for the faint-hearted, Dr. Dave. Yes, Philemon, definitely. You can see the emergence of Philemon and the beautiful, beautiful painting, I think, that we all just can really identify with as we take a look at how Jung honored that relationship. That definitely became his guide. And as Jung says, the work that he did in those in that time with the Red Book becomes what informs the whole rest of his career, and that relationship with Philemon ends up informing him the rest of his life.
Well, what else can you tell us about the Red Book? I mean, it seemed like he really ran with this, or it ran with him. The idea, you know, this active imagination. It's clear, you know, somebody wrote a book years ago, I think, referring to Jung as the mad something or other, suggesting that he was actually crazy. But if you look at what was going on in his life at that time, he was actually carrying on a clinical practice and having regular relationships with people, all the while he was having this other contact, right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, Jung speaks again and again in the collected works about the need to meet the unconscious halfway. And Jung is speaking about something he knows, because in the Red Book, that's what he did. He made sacrifices in his outer world, a number of them. He let go of being a president of one of the psychoanalytic in a group there, and also being the head editor of the major publication. He let go of also his work at the Berzoli Clinic, where he was becoming quite famous. So the shining star energy that was driving the ego complex out into the world so strongly, he made a very distinct sacrifice in the outer world to meet the unconscious halfway and then dive into these experiences with the imaginal that we see in the Red Book. Now, it's interesting to think about, you know, for many of us who live with the rational world, you know, so we're identified with it, to think of what Jung did seems just completely impossible. My God, he sat down with himself and, you know, every night was, you know, taking all the time he needed to just write down everything that came to him in these visionary states. And yet, the truth is, in Zurich at the time, that's what people were doing. I live in Santa Fe now, I have for 22 years, and, you know, I have to say, when I read about what's behind Jung happening in Zurich at the time, there was a foundation for everything that we think of as, quote, the New Age movement, and I think that in quotes. Yeah, so they were talking with automatic handwriting, sub-personalities, as they called it. This was the rage of the day in Zurich. And so this is, of course, what Jung begins to do when he sits himself down. This is the using a candle, the gazing into crystal, the consulting the unconscious, and trying to lower the threshold of consciousness, that abaisement nouveau that is so important. Jung linked himself, you know, to Flournoy and to some of the mystics through time, I think Swedenborg and such, when he started to do the Red Book, he really disidentifies with Freud and the rational mind being in complete charge. So yes, he does go on that edge, you know, where people say, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted to read the Red Book. That's absolutely true. Jung completely confronts the edge of madness, and he does it exquisitely and very honestly. You get a feeling of him, you know, way in there with the fluidity of the imaginal world, and having met the unconscious halfway with making these sacrifices in his outer life, you really see the unconscious meet him, and as you said, it leads to Philemon. But, you know, Dr. Dave, it's interesting. We talk about the Red Book. I have to say the part that tickles me the most is that, you know, it's this huge, laborious work. My God, you know, the suffering that goes on and the birth in him that goes on. And when you really look at the trajectory, which my friend Robin Van Loben Sells likes to point out, I find it to be really true. He starts off, you know, at the beginning with the quote of the sacrifice, you know, that the sacrifice is the cornerstone of what is to come. And so he makes all these sacrifices in the outer world, and he does this inner work really, really deeply. And when he emerges out the other side, you know, we see that the death of the hero complex has completely been the base of the Red Book. And at the very end, what does Jung become but a womb? W-O-M-B. He's become a womb. And that is this receptive vessel to be able to be capable of holding what his soul's about. And he had to learn receptivity and yin. Jung had a lot of yang, and certainly early on, my God, he's 38, 40, when all this is being, you know, happening, he's at a time in life when the ego complex belongs being in charge. So he makes the sacrifice, he takes the plunge, and in the end, he learns this deep yin, feminine receptivity, to be able to balance the yang, and he ends up being able to hold his own soul, and then dot, 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 he walks off into the world. And so that's what we see.
Wow. It's a tour de force that you're giving us here. I was intrigued by your observations about the zeitgeist of Zurich at that time. I didn't realize all that was going on. And the question that was on the tip of my tongue that I think you kind of maybe answered was to wonder, well, geez, today, you know, there have been all these books of channeled wisdom, you know, in the last 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, I mean, we could look at the Red Book maybe as an example of channeling or not.
Well, I think you're asking a really good question because it has to do with, in fact, your telescope's looking way into Jung's psychology, I think, when you ask that, Dr. Dave, because his anima is definitely a mediumistic medial anima. As hard as that is for the rational side of Jung, who is a scientist and a phenomenologist to own, part of his anima is definitely the medial woman. And his dissertation for his doctoral degree was, of course, on the seance material of his cousin, Helen Pryswerk. And
yes.
So that's where it starts, and it doesn't stop there. He goes to, all the way through the collected works. He's interested also in women who have that gift, and that's a mirror to him. Frank Miller, kind of a difficult and it's a complex story about her, but anyway, his work with her and his contact with her material, I should say, because it was really contact with the material that did it, it really showed him his own soul. He even says that as he's looking at her material. And she's a completely mediumistic poet and living in France at the time in Paris. So anyway, I think you're looking in on something really huge about Jung, that he had a hard time pulling together. It could have seemed irreconcilable spirits to him at the time. You know, here he is identified with being medical doctor and doing, you know, real research that has, you know, some real backbone to it, and he's feeling really satisfied by that. And then he's suddenly getting into, oh my God, I'm investigating complexes and, you know, psychological phenomenon and spiritual phenomenon. And so I think you've landed on something very big.
I seem to recall too a story that I think he relates of that he was present with Jung and they were having some kind of conversation where some kind of loud paranormal knock on the wall or something happened, and and Freud was totally taken aback and refused to acknowledge it. Do you recall that story?
Yes, and it links to your earlier question too about, you know, channeled material versus the Red Book and the synchronicity field that operated around Jung and his mediumistic anima. He didn't believe in totally channeling material. He really believed in the ego getting much more centered and part of the creative work than just pure channeling. At the same time, automatic writing and such was important to him, but the cohesiveness of the center of the personality instead of a part that channeled the energy of the higher self. So this is why he called it a partnership. It's so important. And yet, as we're talking about the synchronicity field, yes, this image, this is a moment in time that happens to him with Freud. They're in a big disagreement at the time, and there's a giant report that just rockets through the bookcase. There's also a knife that breaks into four parts, and images of that. You can see a photograph of that. It's really striking. And Jung had parapsychological phenomenon happen around him. I'm sure Freud wouldn't know what to do with that. It would have been, you know, so huge. But Jung, for example, when he's writing Septum Sermonis, which is included in the Red Book, he's, you know, living at his house, and he has, you know, his family sitting down for dinner, and the doorbell is ringing, and everybody knows there's nobody at the door. They get up and look, and in fact, there's nobody there. There are many stories of the psychological phenomena around Jung that would happen in this field of synchronicity. But yes, the ones with Freud are very moving.
So it's interesting that there are these two aspects to Jung, because, you know, you mentioned that he was also had this rational physician researcher side. And I'm struck to discover that there's a lot of contemporary research that uses reaction time as a variable, as a measure. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe he was the first person. He used reaction time as a way to try to get at the complexes.
Exactly. Yes, that's exactly right. That he was the first person to use reaction time and, interestingly, a biofeedback measure. He had the galvanic skin response going with his measuring of complexes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and so it's interesting, you know, if you take a modern psychology course at a regular university these days, the one and only place you're going to hear about Jung is the galvanic skin response, that he had the first biofeedback going along with measurement time of for response.
I certainly didn't hear that when I was in school.
You didn't think that?
No.
I went to UCSD for undergraduate, and that was the only place they had Jung in there, and it made me laugh.
Okay.
When
I was in graduate school, there was a big tome, and I think I've forgotten the title, but it was Theories of Personality by .. It was sort of required reading in those days. I think there was one page on Jung in there, in Theories of Personality.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. And also, given the things that we've been talking about here, it's really clear why Jung kind of became, people got so excited about Jung in the 60s and since, that there's so much that's happened in the culture now that makes us so much more receptive to what he was doing, to that mediumistic side.
I think that's so true. And the unification of these sides, that's what's so interesting too about, like, for forever, world religions have talked about many dimensions of being, and shamanism has spoken about many dimensions of being, and they're into experiencing it, and, you know, bringing a new unification and a new, new adhesion between the worlds has come through, like, indigenous cultures throughout time. And now we've got physics talking about, basically the same thing, from a scientific, you know, languaging lens. And I think this place where the worlds are meeting and our sense of the human being's place in a larger cosmos is really expanding sense of psychology, thank God, because psychology has been so defended against the psyche itself for a long time. And this is, I think, what brings Jung back in, because he wasn't defended against it in that way. So the larger that we get back to that telescope in Coleridge, we get back to, and it's worlds within worlds that we're looking at.
Where does active imagination tie in, if at all, to, say, something like the practice of meditation?
Well, I think that's a provocative question, because meditation we often think of as a stilling of the mind and emptying and quieting, centering. And all of those are important in active imagination, but in active imagination you add the other element of engaging the otherness of spirit that comes in through these images themselves. Images, also kinesthetic felt experiences. Some people experience active imagination, you know, through literal an image, also through a voice, through automatic writing, through also through movement. Sometimes it's shivers in a felt sense, or it's a vibration in the body somewhere. So the way it wants to communicate to us can be, you know, wide. It can be quite varied. So meditation, we think of it as, you know, working to calm and quiet. But active imagination says, well, you do that by getting into dialogue with it first. Then it moves toward the quieting and the centering and a new peace. And I think that's where these things are different. Relationship to the void, very important in Jungian psychology, especially all the fluidity of the imagination and, you know, spirit mercurius archetype of everything, of this phantasmagoria of the psyche completely expressing itself in images all the time. The little person and one's little center, and the way one engages with the images that come and gets it to still itself and you know, dialogue with one and bring something fruitful out of the dialogue is extremely important. With active imagination as meditation, if the fruit of the work comes, you see then the peace and the new centering. But relationship to the void is in meditation, and it's certainly in active imagination.
you know, you just gave me a thought that I hadn't thought of in this way before, which I have on a number of occasions, I've thought I've heard somebody call my name. You know, I've just heard, David,
yes.
know, and there's nobody there. Maybe I'm looking in the wrong place.
Oh, I'm very moved by that. Recently, I was teaching a week on the Red Book for the Groff community in England for their training program. And this came up that oftentimes there's something in the unconscious, and even something we might think of as the ally or the inner partner, that is literally calling your name and trying to call you forth in a new way. It can be quite tender even. One of the women there was mentioning, for example, hearing the great mother call her name down the hallway, and it was evoking her to get up and walk toward where her name was being called, and it was evoking something in her about being loved like she'd never been loved. So yes, when our name is called, it's so important. And this gets into the Sufi window, because they have a great alchemical mystery around the names, that they call the names, and that names themselves have an inhabiting of one's true essence in them. So to use the name of anything is to call forth its divine essence.
Are you saying Goth, G-O-T-H?
G-O-T-H.
The Goth, you said you were working with Goth community.
Oh, I'm sorry. But actually, the Goth would be the teenagers who are really in the Negretto experiences. But no, I Groff, G-R-O-F.
Oh, Stan Groff?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Stan Groff.
Okay.
Yeah, breathwork training community. I'm glad you asked. Yes, because that's an important distinction.
Me too. I was going to say, yeah. I didn't know the Goths had training.
Yeah, they're really quite the Negretto community. I mean, they're really working with the dark and, I guess, counterculture. Looking at the Goth people is interesting as well. But I was saying Groff, G-R-O-F.
Oh, that's a fascinating intersection. You know, I interviewed Stan not so long ago, and he has a book that's very autobiographical, and it's just filled with synchronicity, some really dramatic things, fascinating. So that's really interesting that you're doing some work with you know, in that environment.
I've been so fortunate to have as my very, very dear friend, Diane Haug, who's been Stan Groff's right hand for over 20 years. She's invited me in to teach with her, and it's been such a rich interfacing. I've really enjoyed watching what the Groff community grounds in terms of active imagination. They are using, of course, music and breath as real central, but a very long time period there of containment on one's mat, dropping into the imaginal and feeling it and experiencing it, and then taking it right to drawing mandalas. Very Jungian. I mean, I have to say, it's the interfacing is quite easy to do. And it's fun to work with the Groff people because they are deep in the experiences and they appreciate getting some pieces of the map that comes from the Jungian tradition. So it's a good interfacing.
That's very fascinating. That might need to be the subject of a future interview.
Fun.
if there's enough to say around it.
Yes, so there surely is.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because that sounds fascinating. I just had a few tastes of that work, and I think it's fascinating work. So, so what are some of the types? Oh, I guess I wanted to ask you, too, about the relationship to dreams and dream work. That's probably an important question.
Oh, yes. Really good to start an active imagination from a dream you've had, because a dream is such a pure transmission from something of the unconscious. It drops you in with, for example, a figure that you may have met in a dream, or a tension, or something that feels unreconcilable. So you take a piece from the dream, and or even the whole dream itself, and then, you know, sitting still in the quiet, asking the figure or the presence of what it is to, you know, communicate to you and allow it to, you know, the energy will move. You get either a felt sense or an image that comes, or you try to get it to talk to you. Then the imaginal starts to flow, and then the bridge gets built. Then you're starting to get related to what it is that came in the dream. And that goes forward then in the act of imagination. It's classic pattern for Jungians to want to take the dream work to active imagination to get the relationship to grow and to be able to have it move. And it's also fun to watch when you do that the dreams also pick up that theme, and the dreams are dreaming it further along as well. They continue the field of the active imagination you've done to show you what's come next?
Well, since I think a number of therapists and therapists in training will be listening to this interview, let's move it into its uses in psychotherapy, and we might start with your own personal experiences as you were going through your own analytic process, psychotherapy process, and your training. What role and what kinds of experiences did you have with active imagination during that period? If it's not too personal.
No, it's not too personal. It's just more, Dr. Dave, that it just, you know, I'd be careful not to grab the ball and run here too far. The core of my own healing as a Chiron wounded healer has absolutely come from contact with the imaginal. That started way back when I got into analysis in the early 80s. And the way that working with dreams and the active imagination helped me heal from ovarian cancer. So in my own life, physical and psychological healing has definitely come through work with the imaginal. And that would be a whole topic, I bet. I guess if I were to give an example of something, you know, working with the body, working with physical symptoms, it can be a very alive process to also use active imagination with, to get the part of the body that is having trouble to talk, to move, to communicate somehow. Sometimes it'll come through color or vibration or a felt sense, or sometimes it'll even, you know, communicate a song lyric to you, or, you know, actual words. But getting different parts of our psyche and body and lives to somehow speak to us if it's stuck. So it's really about, when energy's stuck, how do we help it, how do we free a spirit by using the active imagination field? And certainly in my life, that's been the ongoing cornerstone for my own life and work. So
you used the phrase a Chiron wounded healer, and I'm not sure what that means.
Well, there's the myth of Chiron is a lovely Greek myth that shows the archetypal pattern behind all of us wounded healers, and it puts us on good, humble ground. And Jung was certainly a Chiron figure. He was certainly Chiron. Chiron was the head of the centaurs who suffers a wound when he comes out of his cave one day. There's this ruckus going on, and a stray arrow from Hercules' bow lands in the back of his heel, and he tries to get it out. They call in all the shaman. No one can heal it. No one can fix it, and he crawls off into his cave and eventually gets the arrow out, but the wound won't stop. Weeping and being infected, and he learns in his cave with the help of the imaginal realms a number of healing arts, and he learns, you know, active imagination, and he learns, you know, shamanic journeying, and he learns acupuncture, and he learns all the healing arts. This apothecary, he starts to grow and grow and grow, and he walks into the world then with his apothecary of healing gifts and tools, and his wound is never completely healed. And that's an important piece, is that the wound weeps still. And this wounded healer puts us all on really good, humble ground. A lot of us are attracted to this deep work with the magical and amazing realms of the psyche and psychoid, and the reality of the wound grounds it. It keeps us in very, very connected to the human, and with also humor, for sure.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it, the wounded healer, as a grounding reminder.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that aspect before, and that's an important one to remember.
Yeah.
And that motif finds its way again in the Grail legend, doesn't it? The wound to the heel and the weeping wound that won't heal?
Absolutely true. And see, now this is so important that you bring that in, because that's the Grail legend and the Grail cup when we talk about the Red Book and Jung's own experiences with the depths of the imaginal worlds. He becomes at the end that womb, which is the Grail cup that can contain some of the mysteries of the soul itself, and let the soul have its own life. And the Grail legend is also about that. It's the healing that's trying to happen for the Grail King, but it's also the healing of the worlds and the ability for what lives in the spirit world to find its way into our world, and it requires us working with our wounds in order to do that. And when we work with the wound, we get connected to something bigger, and it's, to me, that's, if we lose that piece, we've lost the map and we've lost the flow of life energy, and so bringing up that piece about the wound and the Grail legend is really important.
What about your own clinical experience as a Jungian analyst yourself, are there any case examples that you could share of a time when you introduced some kind of an active imagination approach and, you know, what that led to?
Let's see. In clinical work, I mean, it's just all the life happens when people are getting connected to the dream world and active imagination, because you're getting other points of view. And the way the psyche is stuck, you suddenly get different points of view. So I think about, for example, one man I knew worked with me who, in the middle of a divorce in which he saw absolutely nothing as his own fault, would get active imagination figures, you know, telling him song lyrics that would just shock him awake about being blind and then waking up. I think when right before he even knew the divorce was going to happen, which was clear to me it was going to happen, before he could sense that it was probably good to everyone around him, the dream message that he had was, you know, you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are changing. You know, and so for him, you know, the times are definitely changing, and his alchemical stone was sinking. He was going quite unconscious, and it was time for him to really dig in with his work. And what was interesting for his act imagination experiences, it never stopped using song lyrics. if you watch, this would be for all your listeners too, you know, when you wake up in the morning, what song is on your mind and how is that communicating something? And to listen in, and this is the, I think the part that is where we need someone sometimes to help train us to get the attunement of the symbolic ear to hear the way the psyche is communicating. So if you wake up with a song lyric, for example, that's the activated imagination speaking to you, and to get, you know, what is it saying and what does that mean for me, it would be the art of learning to really hear it.
Yeah, I've had that experience many times, not upon waking up, but just in the middle of my day, and I'll notice that there's a song running through my head, and then I look at the lyric and I realize with a shock what a profound commentary it is about what's going on with me right then.
Perfect, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, Dr. Abe, that's so important to me. Like, we talk about clinical work and daily life. The point is, as Von Font said, is to live with the activated imaginal field and to be open to all the times and ways it's communicating. So it's a way of life. And it, so, yes, we work on it when we sit down to do an exact act of imagination. And, yes, clinical work, trying to get people to bring that material in or get it up and help them work with it, is really important. But we do that as to learn a way to really hear, so that, for example, like when you get that song lyric, you know, you pay attention and you listen, and then you can have a laugh as you're getting realigned, because usually these communications, they're realigning us, they're doing some kind of course correction or attitude correction that puts us in better alignment with the larger self, and that brings more life energy. So it's about the flow of life in the end. But you have to have a sense of humor and agile. You have to be agile, because mm-hmm. it's confrontation with the shadow often, and with what we don't want to see about ourselves.
Yeah. You've used the term activated imagination and active imagination, and even in an email exchange we had before this, you mentioned you wanted to say something about activated imagination. What's the distinction there?
Well, I think the activated imagination, it gives us a feeling of the aliveness of the field of the imaginal realms is actually moving. And, you know, when we say activated, it's like, well, we kind of lean into that a little bit more. It's alive. Like, for example, scintilla in water that might be moving, the vibrational field. So we lean into the activated field of the imaginal with all of our sense organs open. I think sometimes when we say active imagination, we can get, like all things, can get lost in kind of static words. So we want to remember it's a completely alive field that's alive and ongoingly open all the time. So for me, activated touches it more as something we're living with all the time.
Are there examples from film that help to illustrate the kinds of things we've been talking about here?
Yes. In fact, I had meant to bring those in earlier. There's a moment, for example, in in, I think what we begin to realize when we start to tap into the activated imagination field is that it's informing everything all the time, and all creative process is deeply informed by the activated imaginal field. Think of Shakespeare and all these characters that get birthed. He gives them a life. You know, they get to get realized. And this is also what's important, is that the images themselves, the presences themselves are seeking their realization just as we're seeking healing or realization. And in film, if we go to Tolkien, there's a beautiful image in there where Lady Galadriel is giving all of the sojourners gifts, and she is standing over her scrying field, Cate Blanchett at her finest, and she holds in her hands a gift for Frodo, and she says to him, "You, Frodo, last but not least, I give to you the light of Arendil's star. May it be a light for you when all other lights go out." Now, that is a really profound moment. She hands him then this vial that has Arendil's waters, the living waters of her ability to scry and to see. So she's a medial anima figure. She's handing our humble little sojourner Frodo this vial that then it's going to have a light in it for when all other lights go out. Now, what's important about that is the light of the ego is not enough to get us through our lives. Mm. And its light, its way of seeing is not enough. And the light literally can go out at certain times. If you know, go through a divorce or a depression or go through some dark change and you can't see the way, really important, getting lost. So when the ego's lost, it has to reach for a deeper source. And in film, that moment is really depicting what will happen for Frodo. He gets in a dark situation and he needs a light that's more than his ego light. And it's coming from this soulful work with the imaginal then, but it creates a light force that helps him see in this dark cave and find his way. And that's true for us. We do our work with the imaginal. It creates this, like that light of Arendil's star. There's a way that it has a presence that works to have a life with us and help guide us when we're quite lost. So that's one image from film. I could go on.
Well, that's a good one.
Good.
I think active imagination has kind of worked its way into lots of non-professional and semi-professional settings. So,
Yes. So
I'm wondering, you know, who and when is it good for? Are there contraindications? Are there dangers?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think certain personalities are more permeable to the imaginal realms and can also sometimes be. Sometimes because of that, more compelled. And when, in fact, to balance themselves in the world and to grow that stone, they may need to do actually some things that are kind of functional and earthy to help the ego learn how to separate out. So we have to be a little careful about what's guiding the urge to do active imagination work. And sometimes having a Jungian analyst who knows the territory well, of course, I'm from that tradition, I would, of course, say that. That can help one orient, because sometimes one can get very deep into the imaginal and need actually more ego function in the world. That's one of the things that can happen. So I joked with the Groff community in September in England that we have to be careful also of the AAA club, the Archetypal Addicts Anonymous club, where we're constantly looking for the next experience of the numinous, and it doesn't like that, and it gets us out of balance. So doing active imagination for the wrong reason, just I think you have to be aware that it will course correct us. It'll give us a course correction. It's not for entertainment. It is for, though, realigning, and it will confront us with shadow pieces. So I think be ready for whatever you get. Get help as necessary to understand what's happening. If a process gets too hot, do what the alchemists say and turn the flame down. But also when you get quite stuck in life, turn the flame up. Turn up the flame of looking in with the imagination and, you know, get it to help you. Shake the tree some of your, you know, your relationship to the mysteries and help it wake up with you. But that regulation of how high, how low, sometimes people need help with that. I think actually can be quite often important to get an outside person helping you out.
What would be your advice to therapists and therapists in training who want to develop this set of skills to add to their toolbox?
Let's see. I would recommend if people are really wanting to be able to have it for themselves in their own practice and then also use it in their practice, to read those two books of Jeff Raff's, read Jung and the Alchemical Imagination as the first one, and then do the second one, The Practical Work to Ally Work. Practical Guide to Ally Work. That one has really, really good step-by-step pieces in it. I also think that von Franz's message that she says we have an ethical responsibility to what it is that we receive when we do active imagination is a really important piece here, because at the center of working with the imaginal is the development of the integrity of one's character. And not only are these other dimensions realizing themselves, but human beings are getting more integrity to how their character actually moves and operates in the world. And that integrity of character, I think, for therapists is really something to see. You get a chance to see how the psyche confronts people, all of us, with pieces of shadow elements that we're not aware of, with parts of our wound that may be unconscious. And so the fruitfulness for therapists is that it's a direct inroad to the kind of work we want to do to help ourselves and those we work with integrate more fully, with more glue to and more consciousness to the center of who we are. So I think knowing that there's ethical responsibility to deal with what gets produced and to face it, whatever's coming up, helps a sober note in there that therapists then can help their clients with. Because it is a confrontation with the unconscious after all. It's not all so easy. So again, that agility and humor helps. So I think for therapists to introduce it to in their work is to experience it themselves. Pick up those two books, get it going inside themselves, and watch how the fruitfulness starts to appear. But definitely keeping the eyes wide open and some humor and agility helps.
Well, that sounds like a great place for us to wrap up this wide-ranging and wonderful conversation. So, Dr. Monica Wickman, thanks for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. A complete joy to talk with you again.
Wow, it felt really great to connect with Dr. Monica Wickman again. I really like the fact that she's not only very knowledgeable, but also that she's very down to earth and open. And of course, I also appreciate the fact that she's very supportive of Shrink Wrap Radio and is very accessible as a guest. As a matter of fact, she sent me an email right after our interview proposing a topic for a future conversation on Jung and the star-strewn sky. I definitely plan to take her up on that sometime down the road. In the same email, she also gave me the contact information for the author she mentioned several times in the interview, Jungian analyst Dr. Jeff Raff. I will definitely be contacting him quite soon about a possible interview. Some of the high points for me in this interview were the times Monica's remarks triggered my own musings and recollections. For example, about my own water play in a mountain creek as a boy, the name of which just now comes back to me as Mill Creek. It's in the San Bernardino Mountains where my grandparents had a cabin when I was growing up. I wonder if Monica would have recognized that place. Also, she stimulated that memory of me occasionally hearing my name called, as if from without, but nobody was there. The next time that happens, I hope I'll have the presence of mind to wonder what might be going on inside me that's trying to get my attention. I also appreciated our discussion early in the interview about alchemy and what for me was a new thought, which was the connection to magic. I also like the way that Monica's perspective helps us to see active imagination in a much broader context than specific activities such as journaling or dream work. As she pointed out, it's part of a larger activity of tuning into, perceiving, and communicating with the imaginal dimension, which is around us all the time in our daily lives. I look forward to more such conversations with Monica Wickman, and I hope you do too.
I'm free and ready to grow. You know
Yes, I've got the key to the highway, and I'm going to keep on walking and talking all the way to the break of day. And more specifically, I've moved ahead to now being able to offer you access to both an iPhone and an Android app for Shrink Wrap Radio. Just go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click on the Apps tab at the top of the page for full instructions. These apps offer the benefit of giving you access to the full Shrink Wrap Radio catalog of episodes, now at 286 shows. Plus, the app streams the shows to you, saving precious space on your device. However, if you do know that you're going to be out of range for streaming, you have the option of clicking on a star, which then downloads that episode or episodes to your device until you later unstar them. Other benefits of these apps are that they allow you to directly, from your device, leave a voicemail on my phone, email me, or post to my Twitter or Facebook pages. And finally, a portion of the $2.99 that you pay for the app goes to support Shrink Wrap Radio. So just look for the Apps tab at the top of the shrinkwrapradio.com website. And as you can imagine, I'm excited about this and eager for you to download the app and to get your feedback. In other news, I announced on the last show that I was going to Vienna to cover a logotherapy conference there. Well, I was planning to use my credit card miles for that trip, and even though the conference is months off, in March actually, the airlines have limited seats for mileage customers, and I just wasn't able to get the dates I wanted. So I've canceled that trip. I've never been to Vienna before, so I'm disappointed that I won't have a chance to see it just now or to meet up with listeners there. I was supposed to meet up with a couple of listeners there a year or so ago when I went to Prague for a market research conference. And on that occasion, a strike and a volcano and the birth of a grandchild all conspired to have me cancel the planned Vienna leg of the trip. Maybe sometime in the future I'll get there yet. We have a new transcript on the site. It is number 275, Understanding Laughter as Medicine, with Dr. Madan Kataria. And that transcript was done by Ruth Gutteridge. So thank you so much for that, Ruth. And you other transcribers out there who are working on transcripts, you know, if you just plug away at them a little bit a day, you know, if you were to spend 20 minutes a day, let's say, it would be done, you know, in the matter of a week or so. So please keep at it, and we could always use more transcriptionists. Today's interview with Monica Wickman is yet another in the series of Jungian interviews that I've been conducting, and as you know, I've been able to bundle them into CE courses for my professional listeners who need to keep their various licenses up to date. And at this point, there are three such courses, with more on the way, for a total of 20 units at less than $10 a unit. Just click on the store tab at shrinkwrapradio.com for more details. And as you may remember from last time, I replaced the big green donate button with an icon of applauding hands. This at the suggestion of one of my listeners. She didn't suggest applauding hands, but she thought maybe I should try something different. But I'm thinking of going back to the big green donate button. Which do you prefer? Or is there a different icon that you think would be more effective in getting listeners to help support this show? Thanks to all of you who have made one-time and continuing contributions. I really appreciate it. And thanks also to those of you who resolve to do so right now.
Hi, this is Dr. Ofer Zur, forensic psychologist and the director of the Zur Institute. And you are on a couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Ofer Zur, who will likely be my next guest. More about that a bit later. First, let's go to some recent communications from our listener community. First, we hear from Winia, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I love shrink wrap. I am evangelical about it and tell friends. How about a Facebook page? That would make it easier to share the love. Keep it up. We're listening. Wynia. Wynia, well, I'm glad to hear that you're so evangelical. I just love that. And do keep spreading the word. And, you know, we do have a Facebook fan page. It's the URL is too long and complex to read out over the air, but there's a link to it in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com. And I'm happy to have listeners become friends. It would be helpful when you make the friend request if you do indicate that you're a listener. Finally, I received a voicemail from an unidentified listener. I love getting these voicemails. They come all too infrequently. However, this one was too long to play the whole thing, so I'll share this edited down version right now.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm a regular fan, listener to both your podcasts, and always enjoy them and learn a lot from them. And I particularly wanted to compliment you on, thank you for Shrink Wrap Radio number 283 with James Fetterman, I think is how you say it. I'm definitely going to go to your site and buy his book. I thought it was just a really interesting program. I just wish that it could have been longer, but you did manage to discuss a lot of very important, interesting topics with him. I wanted to comment on something that you said in your little afterword. In fact, you mentioned something that I think is a real good point. I'm so glad you brought it up, and that was the psychedelics that you took in your graduate student days were basically street drugs. And I had often wondered about that. I've only taken any psychedelic type drug once, and that was LSD. It was back in about 1981, probably. I was 21 years old. It was extremely positive. It was probably one of the most transformative and positive experiences I've ever had in my life. There was so much that you said that I was just nodding my head right along, you know, like, for instance, you, towards the end of your comments, you said something about, you know, well, you can't go home again, but, you know, you're wondering if maybe just one more time. And I have wondered the same thing, you know, how many years, 30 years, I guess, since my trip. And I've really been wanting to do it again, too, under the right circumstances. Thank you again for your programs. They're both wonderful. One of these days, I promise I'm going to do some transcription. All right. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, unidentified listener, for sharing your own experience. I look forward to your doing a transcription at some point, and I'm really glad to hear that the discussion with Dr. Jim Fetterman hit home for you. I'm glad also to learn that your single LSD experience was so positive and led to some lasting changes in terms of your openness to a much wider range of ideas and experiences. In the portion of your message that I didn't play here, you mentioned that you are bipolar. You didn't ask for my opinion, but I do need to let you know that I'd take that as a contraindication for further psychedelic exploration. As you correctly recalled from my commentary, we can't go home again. As much as we might like another taste of that nirvana, we can't step in the same river twice, is another way of putting it. You were blessed to have such a positive experience 30 years ago, and given your bipolar condition, I'd advise against tempting fate. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails like the one you just heard on Skype. Actually, that one came on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Dr. Monica Wickman for sharing her work with us on Jungian active imagination. My next guest will be Dr. Ofer Zur, who has been on the show once before speaking about trauma. On this coming episode, we'll be discussing telehealth as it pertains to mental health. In other words, therapy rendered via email, phone, or Skype. I'm interested to know the ethics, legal status, and efficacy of this approach. It should be informative and fascinating. So until then, This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.